Hey listeners, this is Travis Book, bassist and singer in the bluegrass band The Infamous String Dusters. I started the Travis Book Happy Hour to try to get to the root of what makes my contemporaries tick, what inspires and motivates them, and why they make music. It's an hour where we get to play together, talk about life, and do it all in front of a live studio audience. If you haven't listened yet, maybe check out some of my highlights, including Sierra Hull, Beppe Gambetta, Tim O'Brien, and Lindsay Liu. You can find every episode of the Travis Book Happy Hour on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, hello, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. It's me, Cindy Howes, the host. Thank you for joining us. Before we get into our conversation with Eric D. Johnson of Fruit Bats, there are a couple things I want to go over. Basic Folk is a listener-supported podcast, so there's a couple different ways you can support Basic Folk. The first one is financially. You can make a contribution at our website, basicfolk.com, under the donate link. And if you give at least $5 a month or $60 yearly, you can get access to our bonus content, which is called Backstage. In fact, we have something really cool that we just posted a couple of weeks ago. It's an extended lightning round with Aeneas Mitchell that you can check out if you are a member of Backstage. And if you're not, you can make a contribution and then you'll have access. Another way that you can support Basic Folk is by signing up for our mailing list, where you'll get a monthly newsletter and a couple of announcements here and there. We don't spam or anything like that, so you can sign up for that. That's also really helpful for us to be able to stay in touch with you. Or you can follow us on the evils of social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Basic Folk Pod. Or you could tell a friend. You can leave a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts, or you can just like keep on listening and supporting us that way, which is totally fine. Okay, Fruit Bats have been on the indie rock radar since the early 2000s, so I'd say that calls for a double album compilation documenting their 20 years of music. However, the brains behind Fruit Bats and its only regular member, Eric D. Johnson, is a man who tends to solely look forward. Thankfully for us, he rolled up his sleeves, dug into some old hard drives, and sifted through two decades of MP3s, waves, AIFFs, and the like that make up the band's brand new collection, Sometimes a Cloud is Just a Cloud, Slow Growers, Sleeper Hits, and Lost Songs from 2001 to 2021. On Basic Folk, Eric talks about growing up constantly moving around and the impact on him then and now. He also gets into his time working at Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago. His time there allowed Eric to evolve and embrace his folk musicality as well as the punk side he was nurturing in Chicago's scene. He also gets into reframing career aspirations after he saw a lot of his friends who came up in indie rock at the same time he did, reaching new heights that Fruit Bats just simply weren't. He was afforded many amazing opportunities before he was ready, recording Fruit Bats' debut album with Tim from Caliphone, and then getting signed to Sub Pop thanks to the Shins and Modest Mouse advocacy for Fruit Bats. He talks about how he felt about those chances back then, how he reflects on them now. His time playing with the Shins allowed him to climb into someone else's work a little bit, which gave him perspective on his own. There was a time when Eric ditched the Fruit Bats' name to record under his initials, EDJ, in what he calls a career-stalling move. But I pressed him to expand on the fact that it might have been a really necessary move for him personally. He's been recording and playing under Fruit Bats again since 2015, which he sees as like a new era for Fruit Bats, which he gets into. I also brought up Bonnie Light Horseman and the incredible vocal pairing of himself with Aeneas Mitchell, who he calls his main singing partner these days. Eric D. Johnson is seriously the nicest guy in indie rock, and I'm here for that. Hope you enjoy. Let's check out a song from Fruit Bats before we get into this conversation. Here's Without Any Airs, and then we will hear from Eric D. Johnson of Fruit Bats on Basic Folk.
One, two, three. I really wish I had some vision of hope, some beacon in the dark. Keeps getting dimmer. Oh no. save us from a slippery slope, a sliver of hope. But the sliver keeps getting slimmer. Oh no. And the slope is, it's getting slicker. Yeah, it is. Without a reason, without a way, without a crest of our family name, without any ends, without any ends, without any ends.
Eric, thank you so much for being on Basic Folk. It's so great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you grew up moving around the Midwest in the suburbs of Chicago a lot, like about 13 times, I think, before you turned 18. And you've spoken about like your weird sense of nostalgia as a kid because of that. So as an adult, what has been your sense of nostalgia like now? Or like how else do you see moving around that many times impacting you still?
That's a good question. That's like a extra heavy question right now too, because everything is just like, remember 2019, 100 years ago? Like it all sort of feels like that. So I don't even know how to answer that right at this moment. But I think like what you're asking, like I had a pretty nomadic childhood, pretty like nomadic adulthood. Honestly, like the longest place I ever lived, which I don't even live there anymore, was Portland, Oregon, which I sort of came to that realization recently when people are like, where are you from? I'm like, I mean, I grew up in the Chicago area, so that's sort of it, but I might be from Portland, actually, because I logged in the most hours there. But
how long?
8 years, or actually 10 years, really. So eight years and one. It was the house I lived the longest in my life was in Portland, Oregon. Like, by far, actually. So, yeah.
That's got to be so weird. I've been thinking about that as, like, I didn't have a nomadic childhood, but, like, since college, it's, like, every year or 2 years, like, moving from place to place to place. So it must be, like, so wild for you to, like, have stayed in one place for a really long time.
Yeah, it's clearly, like, and you know, I've moved around a lot as an adult. I didn't really have to, but that's been more of like a choice. I don't dislike it. I like that perspective shift. But like you were asking, it's like the it sort of forces you into nostalgia because you're like, oh, remember 5 years ago when I was in. You're not like, yeah, like when you move 13 times when you're a kid, everything is like in the rear view, you know. My wife lived in the same house her whole life. So like every you know, her whole childhood. So all her references are like, it's just like that house, you know, but mm-hmm. I'm always like, yeah. I could tell you what was going on in 1983 because I know what house I lived in.
You have
in.
A timestamp.
So, yeah, there's a timestamp. Yeah.
So when you were growing up, like where was music in your life? Like what were your family's like listening habits? Did anyone play music? Who was like bringing you like the good stuff to listen to?
My family, they all enjoyed music. Like my mom was a really good singer. They listened to like top, we had like the radio on in the family, you know, like they weren't listening to like skiffle records or something. They like for pretty much my whole childhood, like just the major radio stations playing the radio hits. I think that probably had like a pretty profound effect on me, like 1980s top 40 radio.
In Chicago?
Or Chicago or Detroit or wherever we were living at the time. So in Chicago, it was...
I wonder if you have like, you know, you'd like moved around to like different houses, but you were like listening to the same like Chicago heritage rock station as a kid.
Yeah, it was like certainly like we were in Chicago from like we moved to Chicago when I was in like fourth or fifth grade. So, which is, that's like a heavy time for listening to.
Sure.
You're really like starting to make your own decisions about like what you like. And so, yeah, it was the radio station in Chicago around that time was called Z95. That was like the top 40 radio station. So I was listening to that. And then like a sort of a realization I had is like, I was like, there was like a specific era of classic rock radio that became really big in the early 90s, which I always thought that that was like unique to me. But when I've talked to more people who are like exactly my age, they were like, yeah, of course. Like it was sort of like, post metal, post like hair metal, pre like Nirvana. There was like this little 2-year stretch where it was like, everybody was listening to like Pink Floyd and like Creedence. They were listening to like music from the late 60s and early 70s. Mm. So that sort of like had this really big effect on me around age 14, you know, like the Led Zeppelin box set came out on cassette and I was like,
right.
Blew my mind. I got like the Grateful Dead. Like it was like the era of greatest hits, you know, they were doing all these like packaged retrospectives and stuff. And so I heard that. And then it was like, then I started to play music. And then it was like, you know, by 1995, I liked indie rock because that was like, I was like starting to play music and I was like, I can't play like Pink Floyd. I can't like rip a guitar solo. Like I was not really a punk. So it was like bands like Pavement and things like that. So the realization I had recently is that like, we think of these, like, your childhood listening is like, these long epic stretches, but they're not. They're like these tiny little phases that you go to and they're all kind of sewn together. But the miraculous realization I had was like in 1989, I was probably listening to like Poison. And in 1995, I was probably listening to like Pavement. And that's only 6 years, you know? Those are two wildly different things to be listening to. So, that was like, but it was just like that like stretch between when you're like 12 and 20 is it's like amazing. So it like makes you who you are from a musical perspective.
So you were on Joe Pug's podcast, Working Songwriter, and great conversation. You said it wasn't really a surprise that you wanted to be a performer. You said, I was a weird little show kid, a real ham in the family, making up songs, writing short stories. What memories do you have of that time and how did it feel to perform as a kid versus to perform as an adult?
I mean, there's a certain fearlessness that comes with when you're performing as a kid because there's like zero stakes. Like and maybe some kids like feel like there's stakes and maybe it's probably different now because it's like YouTube and I can't even imagine like what it's like to be any type of young person right now. But back then it was just like, it just kind of felt like nothing, you know? And like, I don't know, I would like go sing at like there was literally like a local coffee shop. And I would go and like sing songs, but it just didn't feel like anything. It felt like busking or something. And like my friends would come and that was sort of like what indie rock was like then too. It was sort of like a low stakes way to like be creative. And it was like
very nonchalant.
Yeah, very nonchalant. And it was kind of like DIY at the time, sort of like pre-streaming, pre-social media, like however you want to look at it. And I'm not like, I don't want to like idealize it or anything either, but it was just like your hopes and dreams were just like, oh, I want to just like play at like a club on like a Tuesday night. Maybe I would like even go on tour and do it. But it was a really small circuit. Still very like pretty like punk rock, you know? So to have like, I don't know, gone this long and then had like way more happen was like a sort of like a fun bonus.
Totally. You were also talking to Joe about this is very interesting to hear your perspective about the Scando Midwestern vibe that you have where you like don't want to be too showy and always want to be low key, but clearly there's like always been this drive to perform. So how have those two sides lived alongside each other for you?
I think it's just like tiny, tiny learning experiences, along the way. And then just little tastes of things too, where you're like, oh, that kind of felt nice, you know, to have, I definitely sort of what I was telling Joe in that podcast. I just kind of came from a family where there wasn't like a total premium put on like performing. I felt like it was like sort of embarrassing, you know, to do it. Mm-hmm. Like it was like a silly thing to do and unrealistic. So I think I had to just get over that at some point. But
like career-wise unrealistic?
Very much so, yeah. It was like not, I did not sort of grow up with that being like an option necessarily. Like the sort of possibility of that was like as out of touch as like being like, I don't know, going to the moon or something. It was just like, that was not, and I was not discouraged or anything either. So I don't, it wasn't like my parents were like the like mean dad from Dead Poets Society or something who was like, you're going to become a lawyer. So like no one was saying that to me. So I'm not, it's not some sob story, but it just wasn't like, it just wasn't like on my radar or like a possibility. So, so again, like, I guess low stakes is like the way I thought of it. It was just sort of like a fun thing to do, but you would do these things and then you play shows with like bands that were on tour and then you'd maybe go on tour yourself and you just kind of like see how things worked and be like, oh, this is actually like a thing that you can actually do, but you have to sort of like pull the curtain back, you know, in order to figure that out. So I just did.
So when you moved to Chicago, you became involved with the local music scene there. You got a job at the Old Town School of Folk Music. You taught classes and worked as a house manager for concerts. Like you were like the sound guy there.
I was not the sound guy. I was like the like hospitality guy. I would like, you know,
the clipboard guy.
Yeah, I was the kind of the clipboard guy. And occasionally I would be like the host too. Like I would like announce the bands and stuff. So
did you like hosting?
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed it. It was like just a way to get up on stage.
Nice.
I mean, it was like you're up on stage for like 1 minute and you'd be like, ladies and gentlemen, Richard Thompson. Or but yeah.
Can you talk about the Old Town School of Folk Music and maybe how the community there helped you figure out who you were musically?
Yeah, I mean, when I started there, it was pretty like, it was still really folky. Like everyone was like 20 years older than me and literally, I mean, it was like an extension of that sort of 50s and 60s folk revival. It was sort of like Chicago's version of like the Greenwich Village scene, very like Peter, Paul and Mary, New Christy Minstrels kind of stuff. So I was like super removed from that. I was like not, I was clearly not in that scene, but I was interested in traditional music too in some ways. I was sort of more interested in how I could like learn about traditional music and then like make it weird, you know, or subvert it in some way. But like I liked having that sort of base for it. Mm-hmm. And then that place was so cool because if you got a job there, you could sort of like you could make a life out of it. And they were very like, it was sort of like having a family that for the first time that was like, you got to see a bit of the world of possibility, but it was mostly pretty like, you know, the teachers and things were older, but actually the other teacher who was close to my age at the time, who obviously everybody knows now, it was Andrew Bird. So it was
right.
So, and there was like a few people, there was like a little bit of a younger crew, but like, yeah, I taught classes there. I think the thing I learned there the most was like how to perform, because you teaching group classes to like groups of 20 people, you're singing together. It's like a very beautiful thing, you know, and pretty unique. Like it's like teaching, it's like 20 people playing some song on guitar all at once, which is a strange and beautiful sound in and of itself. But also for me, it was like, I would teach like sometimes three classes a night. It was like 6 hours worth of just like singing and being in front of people. And it was like a total way to, it was like, I figured out who I was as a performer and like a person on stage doing that, which is sort of a very weird, avenue for that. But yeah, that was like a lot what I took from that.
Right. Well, like on the opposite end of that spectrum, when you were first starting to play in bands in the 90s, you've talked about like how there was kind of like a premium on being a jerk, like being like territorial or kind of nasty. And I think maybe in thinking about like the punk scene or the rock scene. But how did you see that change over time? Because you have like talked about how, you know, things are different now. And what do you think caused people to get nicer?
I don't know. I think it's a generational thing. I think if anything, it wasn't like that people got nicer. I think at least the people that were around me or that I like chose to be around was like the nicest possible people. So I'm not, I wouldn't say like,
maybe you self-selected.
I self-selected, but yeah, I think it was straight up just the lineage from punk rock. I mean, it was like, if you think about like what the venues were like still in the late 90s and early 2000s, the whole reason why like rock venues were crappy was because in the 1970s, punk rock was a controversial, weird thing, and the only clubs that you could book them in were the worst dive bars, you know, that were sort of like unregulated and weird. And then that became the look and feel of punk rock, and that just carried over to indie rock. And I was making this like gentle songwriter version of that, but those were just still the venues at the time. That those were like still the worlds. We would even like play venues in like, you know, in those really early days, and there would be like a punk band on the bill, and it was like us doing our thing. It was just like, it was just kind of like still a weird Wild West. Sort of like funny to think the year 2000 was still closer to the 70s or as close to the 70s as we are from it more or less now. Mm-hmm. So there was still kind of that feeling in the air. But yeah, territoriality, scenes, and I don't know, just stuff like that. It's like, yeah, just the feeling of like going to a club on tour on a Tuesday night and there was nobody there and everyone's just like, what the hell are you doing here? You know? So yeah, I think things have gotten nicer because like just that they've moved out of that generation. Like venues are nicer now. Again, there's more of a premium on niceness.
Mm, definitely. So here's a little bit of a setup here. Thanks to one of your students from the Old Town School of Folk Music, you were introduced to and then ended up joining the band Caliphone. And then from there, you would meet the guys in Modest Mouse and the Shins and were afforded these opportunities that you have claimed in some situations that you weren't ready for. Like Tim from Caliphone put out your Fruit Bats debut, and Isaac from Modest Mouse and James from the Shins got Sub Pop interested in signing you. And I've heard your bandmate, Aeneas Mitchell, talk about this before, like being given opportunities before you're ready. So what can you say about like that time in your life, how you felt about those chances back then, how you reflect on them now? Like, were you grateful at the time or did you feel like you like deserved them?
I think as far as like the deserving of them, that's really hard to say. Like you, like if you're given an opportunity and it's like maybe before you're ready, maybe you don't deserve it at the moment, but you better retroactively be like, okay, like I need to like honor this in some way, even if I wasn't ready for it. You know, I don't know if that's a bad explanation of it or a good explanation, but, and plenty of people are given opportunities or not, you know? So I did my best to like act on them. I was just sort of young and like, I mainly mean from a creative perspective, I was like, wow, I was given like the keys to the car. And, maybe it's just cause I'm my own worst critic too, but where I was like, oh, I'm not sure I like nailed that. I should have like worked harder. This is maybe just me like looking back on it and being like, man, that's not as good as I'm not as good as I am now. So, but like, yeah, I think I was like, that may have just been the time too, where you're just like, there was like, again, a different standard, a different premium. And indie rock was more of a, like, I've said this before, but like, I'll say it again. It was more of a developmental league at the time. It was like you would sort of, they would kind of sign you based on like, oh, that's, this person's could be interesting. We'll see what happens with them. Mm-hmm. Now, I think people are, it's just harder now. You have to be more fully formed.
Gotta have like the numbers and the clicks.
Yeah. And it's streams. And like pop music and indie rock and everything, it's all kind of like the same now. But back then it was like famously, I think it was like someone at Sub Pop famously said to James Mercer from Shins, like, with that, when that first, they delivered that first record, he was like, wow, you might sell 20,000 copies of this. Like, which was like, they sold like over 500,000 of it. But, yeah, wow. But where that was, so it gives you an idea of like where people's brains were at, just as far as like numbers went. They were like, we're in this world. But now it's like, everything is just like, it's all kind of the same. It's good and bad. I don't really know how to like, my perspective on it now is like, I don't know, like I'm just inside of it. So I don't,
yeah.
I don't know if it's like good, bad or otherwise.
I work in radio and it's kind of a similar thing, like public radio right now. It's like, it just might as well be those like little, independent alternative rock stations, like, you know, that we all listen to growing up. You know, that's basically what public radio is like, where it's like, because it is all about like numbers and audience listening and all that stuff now. But like back then it was like, in the, like, we're going to play like Richard Schindel because we like him, you know? And
sure.
Anyways, tangent.
I think I house managed Richard Schindel show actually at one point at the Old Town School.
He's a lot nerdier than I thought he was going to be.
Yeah, I don't have my remembrance is hazy, so I don't know.
I was also when you were talking, we were talking about the opportunities that you were afforded when you were younger. Like I was thinking, you know, thinking of my own experience being in college and working at like a very successful college radio station, and I was such an asshole, you know. And then like a few years later, you get a taste of the real world, and I'm like, okay. No, I'm not going to be an asshole anymore.
What college radio station was it?
WERS, Emerson's station.
Oh yeah, I wonder if I ever. I feel like back in the again, like not to get all like back in the olden times, but that was always like, you know, like when you would like be in an indie band, you would tour, you just do so many more college-y things like that. Mm-hmm. It's like not a thing anymore as much, but like not just college radio, but like you would even go play at colleges and play in like the student union and
make
like,
some money.
Yeah, it was like this thing. I remember like that was always like a huge deal. If you're like, ooh, we got like a college show, I was like, you know, and they would pay you like $1,500 or something, like big money,
right?
Compared to like some, right, weird club show.
Well, it's funny, the station that I worked for, it's like so different now, but when I was in college, it had all these like block programming shows. So the show that I was on for like all 4 years was called The Coffee House, and it was a folk show, much like the artists that would come through at Old Town School of Folk Music. We would play those similar artists, but then when I was in school, like Bright Eyes and Saddle Creek and all of and Sub Pop and like all of those like indie acts started like coming up, and I was getting like pressure from like the student management to like play Bright Eyes and play Rilo Kiley like alongside Richard Schindel and Richard Thompson and stuff. But then I got into it, you know. I just didn't know, you know, that world. But we definitely played Fruit Bats on the Coffee House alongside, you know, like Bill Monroe or something weird like that. So it was a cool time. But your song When You Love Somebody is definitely a song we played on the Coffee House from 2003. So that song, I heard you talk about it. It's like a filler song that you said, I wrote it in the time it takes to sing it, but it took off in a way that kind of set you up mentally for like a big breakthrough with Fruit Bats, with the band, but it didn't take off in the way that you thought it would. So like back then, like what was your relationship to success in that time versus now, and like how have your career aspirations versus life aspirations changed?
I don't think I knew at the time what my I was like, it was just so making it up as I went along, and and again, still sort of like had started off with this really like small scale, low stakes vision, and was like, but with each little moment or each little thing that you would see, you'd kind of be like, I want this now, you know. So it was like this, my aspirations. I definitely, like, around that time was when like all of my friends were starting to get like massively huge too. So you sort of, I did start to have sort of bigger visions, because it was like, I saw what was happening to like people who we had been, you know, on tour together, playing to nobody And then they were starting to like fill these giant venues and stuff. So it was like, but I think my relationship to it was still like, I was still working within the bounds of like what I knew how to do, you know? So it was, I did not ever, I think for better and maybe worse, I didn't have like some kind of cynical view of like going in and being like, I gotta like crank out some hits. I always was like, I was like, I'm making relatively catchy 4-minute songs. So it wasn't, there was nothing to like sell out to or not, you know, like I was just like, I'm going to do what I do and it's going to hit or not. And I had seen the same things like with my friends' bands where it was like, I don't know, there was no like cynical, it was like pre-streaming and stuff. And like, even pre like syncs, you weren't like, I need to write this so that we're going to get like put on some TV show or we're going to get like a million streams. But then they just started to get big because there became a taste for that. So I was like, I remember, I think at the time when I think back on it, I'm like, oh, I didn't have any aspirations. But when I actually think about it, I think I did. I think I was pretty disappointed, you know, that I wasn't like doing as well as people. It was more just like disappointing too, because it's just weird when you see it happening to everyone around you and you kind of started off on the same place. And I think whatever happened, I think I kept adjusting and it just took me longer, you know? And then and like some people you have these terrible tours, and I talked about this a little bit with Pug on his podcast, but you like they have these terrible tours and like maybe those are the ones that break you, you know? Like some people quit after that, but I must have been either a glutton for punishment or I had a more of a widescreen vision than I give myself credit for. But I was just like, I kind of kept going. I always have said, I always have one little thing happen every record or every year or something like that. That's like
keeps you in the game.
Yeah. It's never like a life changer where it's just like, and then we synced a song to a car commercial and we got like $500,000 or something. That like, that doesn't happen, but it'd always be like one little thing where it's like, oh, well, I think, okay, that's, I'm gonna be able to do another one of these, and it seems to be working. So yeah, it's a very like sort of slow climb, but it always seems to move forward every year, not by like miles, but by like feet. So yeah.
You haven't seen that Disney movie Encanto? It just came out.
No, I have not yet.
It's like you talking about seeing all your friends like rise up. And you kind of getting left behind and feeling a little disappointed. The lead character in Encanto, you may relate to her struggles. Because everybody in her family has a magical power, and she doesn't have one.
I'm gonna have to watch that. I'll watch that with like my nephews or something. That'd be a good one.
It's a good one. I think, not my favorite of the recent Disney output, but I thought it was pretty good. Generation deals with generational trauma and also, you know, being left behind with the rest of your family is doing something else. Anyways, check it out. So when you played with the Shins 2006 to like around 2011, you said, this is a great quote about that. You said, if you have the ability to play in someone else's band and you're a singer-songwriter and you can do it, there's a lot of good reasons to do it. It gives you perspective on other people. You can climb into someone else's work a little bit and will affect yours, hopefully in a good way. It'll give you perspective on yours. So how did you find your time playing with the Shins impacting your own work?
I mean, it was all that I just said. And then it was like, it was another layer of how I said, you know, every year, it was huge for me in like a million ways, basically. I had always really struggled financially before that, and like I had a lot of day jobs and like pickup work, and sort of since then I've been able to like make a living as a musician. It was like I didn't get like loaded or anything from it, but it was like became this like steady paycheck of like just playing music. And before that I had a craft service company for film sets, so I was like an on-site film set caterer for a long time. And
were you cooking?
Yeah. And so I had like done that for, like, between the Old Town School and the Shins, that was like my day job, which was like, it was a good day job and everything too. And at one point, one of the producers who I worked for was like, you need to stop doing this. You're really good at this. You need to stop doing this music stuff. Like, because like, you're going to like,
you're
have
a really
lot
good
of,
caterer.
Yeah. You're going to have like a lot of success in this world. And like this music thing is like, cause I was having to like turn down jobs and stuff to go on tour. And it was like, a whole thing, but you know, it was like I actually kind of liked that work, but it was like 14-hour days, and like I would always come home like smelling like eggs, and it was like it was really hard work. And it was, but it was also still freelance too, which was great, but also the hard work that came with that too, where you had to like work really hard to like keep it sustaining. So after Shins, I was like, I don't have to do that anymore. It was, I always say, so much of what I learned is like proof of concept too. It was like, A, everything I said about learning more about songwriting and stepping into somebody else's songs every night for 2 years. But also just like being in that band at that moment was like incredible. I got to like, the experiences I had were like unreal. Like really the things that you sort of dream about doing when you're like a kid thinking about being in a band. I got to like do all those. Granted, it was somebody else's songs that afforded me that, but it was still like I played on Saturday Night Live. I like went all over the world and played at these crazy music festivals, and I just got to do all kinds of cool stuff. And it's the type of thing, like I was saying, that just makes you be like, okay, this is how this side of things work. I really want to keep doing this. It just like, it just feeds you, you know, it feeds your hunger for it. And then, you know, and I was never quite able to get to that level, but it made me, I sort of like when my tenure with them was done and I was starting to get back into making Fruit Bats records, I was like, let's like, it was sort of the aforementioned thing of like, let me like dig more into these songs. Like I want this to like hit harder. I just remember the sound of going out on stage with the Shins, like the sound of that audience. I was like, I'd like to figure out a way to hear that sound a little bit more, you know, like the sound of people who are just like over the moon that you're there, you know, instead of the, the like Wednesday night indie rock club, 40 people, which is, I appreciate those 40 people too. I don't want to punish them for being there, but it was just like,
you just want them to bring 10 friends, maybe 100 friends.
Yeah. And that's kind of eventually what happened too. So, and like, once again, another pulling back of the curtain, and being like, oh, here's this other world over here. Sort of see how things work and where you're just like, you know, this was that at that point I was, you know, 6 years into like sort of a music career in earnest, which seemed like at the time, like forever, you know, I was like, oh my God, I'm a grizzled old veteran.
Right.
you know, now, of course, I realize I wasn't, I was still like, but yeah, it was just a great learning experience on every level.
There was a time where you were going through some pretty sad personal stuff and you walked away from the Fruit Bats name in 2013. You put out a solo record under EDJ, which you called a career stalling move. But it seems like for personal reasons, you kind of like needed the reset, and you talked about it. You talk about it now as being like a dumb move. But can you talk about how that might have been a really necessary move for you personally?
I mean, I think it probably was a necessary move. It was one of those, like, you can never go back and you can't think of the fatalistic view of, like, how the dominoes would have fallen or whatever. Like, it was like, it felt like a couple of years after that, it felt like a really dumb move because I really did lose, I lost infrastructure, like the sort of the important things that you need as a actual working person in a band to like make things keep going. Those all went away. I was completely went back to being like the most DIY punk rock person, and this was like after having been in the Shins, and like so it felt I did feel like there was, even at the time, it really sucked, but in my brighter moments I was I kept trying to think of it as a liberating reset to where I was like, yeah, like I think
you watch your bank account go down. You're like, I feel so liberated.
The bank account was gone. Like, yeah, it was gone. I luckily was in a good, like, cheap rental situation at the time. And I will say, if you put out a lot of music, you really get paid pennies to put out music. But if you put out enough of it, the pennies begin to pile up. So, you know, it was like, I was still really like scraping by, but I did not have to go back to doing my craft service catering job. And that was like, you know, but I also think like it gave me a lot of inspiration for writing too. And I think I wrote, you know, I started really getting into writing some of my best material after that too, because you sort of need to have those life experiences. So, yeah. And then once again, I had like some, it's always been like the kindness of friends and peers. And it was like, at that time, it was My Morning Jacket kind of stepped up and took us on a tour and really like helped push us back out. So it's always been like, my friends in those aforementioned more successful bands have often come to my rescue.
Yeah. So like when My Morning Jacket asked you to open for them in 2015, you were like, okay, I'll do this as Fruit Bats. So then you started performing and writing and recording again as Fruit Bats. And you said like everything came back, but it was kind of like a BC and AD to like a before and after, like a new reinvention. So you worked on reinventing the band for the 2016 album Absolute Loser, by unpacking some trauma and creating like a more balanced sound for the band. So how did this whole experience help you realize the power and also the limitations of reinvention, like reinvent yourself, but like not to the point where you're unrecognizable and ruin your career maybe?
Yeah. I mean, like a serious reinvention. I don't know. Like plenty of people can pull that off with perfect precision, and it's fine. It sort of depends on who you are. There's obviously plenty of artists that have done the I just think music fans and audiences are really smart. Like as the whole, like they just, because music is very elemental and kind of simple, and like I think whatever you do, if you're doing it with honesty, I think people just feel that. So if you did a deeply cynical reinvention where you're like, I only make electronic music now, which is not to say anything bad against people who start making electronic music, but if you're doing it because you're, or especially anybody that does the kind of like sellout move of like just making some kind of like really cynical pop record or something like that, I don't know. Like I just think audiences are always smart, and they know what you're doing. Like that's just like music is like it's always honest, no matter what. Even if you're doing it in like a really non-genuine way, there's an honesty in that too. Mm-hmm. I just think like,
oh, interesting.
People know, you know. I don't know. So yeah. People know. People like know what you're saying.
Bonnie Light Horseman, your band with Anais Mitchell and Josh Kaufman, first came together at the Eau Claire Festival in 2018, and I know that you knew Josh before that, but can you talk about how you all first connected and how you keep that initial connection present in the band?
I think, well, Josh I had known a long time, and he's just kind of like, we're both like very social people, and we both run in a lot of worlds, so we had like overlapped with each other like a million times over, and had gotten to be like really good friends over the past like decade or so. Had like made music together, but never anything like seriously in earnest. Like he was always one of those people where I was like, I gotta do something with that guy one of these days. And then Anais and I met the lamest way possible, which is on Twitter. which like she gave me like a Twitter shout out, like at one point. It's like where they're like, I like this band or whatever, you know, and they like tag you. And then I was like, I had kind of just become familiar with her and was becoming a fan. It was like one of those sweet, I don't know, one of the nice things about social media is just the like, you could kind of like cast a line out to a stranger and be like, hey, I like what you do, and and I do things too. And it was sort of like that. And that concurrently was like, was discovering that she was working on something with Josh. She and I also incidentally share the same booking agent. Fruit Bats and Anais Mitchell do the books, the shows. So there was like some, a little bit of just that, like some strands of connectivity there. Yeah, it's like told this story before, so I won't go too into it, but like kind of caught wind that they were doing something and was like, that sounds fun. And it's
yeah, guys,
sort of like, yeah, it sort of like fit in with like some ideas of like what I maybe wanted to be doing around that time. Where I was like, oh, I sort of want to like reconnect to some like folkier stuff. I want to do something a little more collaborative. And yeah, it was just cool. This is like cool starting a new band. I hadn't like started a band since like 1997 or something. So yeah, it was just such a cool, weird feeling. It sort of made us feel like kids or something again, in that, like, or like teenagers or something. We also just really get along well still, and like just like we dig each other. I think we all have like differences and sames that are complementary, and like we're, you know, I don't know, 4 years into the band now too, which is actually kind of crazy. And it sort of still feels like a very honeymoonish period or something. So yeah, like we're like fans of each other. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
The pairing of Anais's voice and your voice together, it's like so brilliant. I like was wondering if you could tell me how you feel about the way your two voices sound together. Cause I can't really think of words that just like are worthy of the description.
Yeah. I think the thing that's cool about it is, I love it. And she's like, you know, at this point now, like I've never really had a singing partner like that. Like where like she's like my most notable singing partner that I've ever had. And like, I think if you'd have like thought about our voices before Bonnet Horseman, you maybe wouldn't have like thought that they would go together somehow. They just do. I think we're like, we just respect each other a lot. And like, I think we have both a sort of a different approach to singing too. So, that like we kind of give each other space, but I don't think there's like a real way to describe it either. It's just like, which I've often had a hard time with Bonnie Light Horseman describing like what works about that band, because it really was like, we kind of just did it on the first day and we were like, this is awesome. Like we just really, it was like pretty great from like the first minute. So it's like a, I don't know, it's just something that works in a way that is a little hard for me to describe, I think. But yeah, I think with like Anais and I are like different in our approaches, and thereby there's like a, there's something complimentary about it, whatever that is.
I would watch a reality TV show of Bonnie Light Horseman making a record, going on tour, doing promo. Do you know, do you know anyone in TV that you can make that happen?
Yeah, I can talk to some people.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Because you are going to put something else out in the spring, I think is what I heard, and original songs. You don't have to tell me any details, but.
Yeah, no, exciting. I think I can even talk. I think I just talk about it a little bit, but yeah, like we like made a new record, so it's happening. It's like, yeah, it's definitely. We do not think of that band as like a side project or anything. I think it's a concurrent concern for all of us of like with all of our stuff that we have going. But yeah, we just like, I don't know. It's like we all love doing it.
Cool. So Fruit Bats have a new collection of greatest hits. Sometimes a cloud is just a cloud, slow growers, sleeper hits, and lost songs, celebrating 20 years of Fruit Bats. It's set in reverse chronological order, which is smart. And you said, it's weird putting out records for 20 years because I've listened to the earlier ones and it was just a different person, a different project. So I'm always interested to know how an artist thinks back on the person they were through the lens of their old work, and what is true for you in that regard?
That's a good question, and I've been being forced to like reckon with that question for so long. And it was sort of like kind of going back to the early part of the discussion of like moving around a lot and sort of like placing a lens on different eras of your life. And what I have learned is I have no perspective at all. Like I don't know like what, I don't know who I was then, like, or sometimes what I think about, like, how I felt about something, I'll actually go back and think a little bit more about it. And I'm like, oh no, I thought completely, it was like the thing you were asking about, like, you know, did I have huge aspirations? I always am like, no, I had none. And then I think like, no, I totally did. What am I talking about? So I don't know. It just goes to show you how much amnesia you get. With these things, and it's like, even the how you look back at it, like the songs themselves as like part of the memory or something, that doesn't even really help. So yeah, it's all kind of the same movie. As I always sort of think of it as like a movie or something that just had a very slow start to it. So like my perspective is that I have less perspective than I even thought. And I think that's kind of a good thing in a way. It's all just been like a weird dream.
Man, well, it's so rad to have that collection of songs. It sounds so great. And I loved what you wrote about it. And before we let you go, will you do the lightning round?
Sure. I don't even know the lightning round, but I'm excited. I'm ready for it.
You're going to love it.
Okay.
These are all very fun questions to show that we contain multitudes, where we can talk about deep emotional topics and we can also talk about surface level basic things. Okay, here we go. What was the first song you learned on the guitar?
That's like a deeper thing, because the weird thing with me learning...
Gotta keep it on the surface.
I gotta keep it on the surface.
I'm just kidding.
I wrote a song. Like, I wrote songs on guitar before I learned a song on guitar. But I think probably... it was probably like "Wish You Were Here" by Pink Floyd, if I was to guess, as far as a cover song goes. Yeah,
that lines up with what you're talking about.
Yeah,
what is your karaoke song?
Ooh, it's "Never Tear Us Apart" by NXS, and I like ballads on karaoke. I like to bring the house down when I'm doing karaoke. Mm. But yeah, "Never Tear Us Apart," or also "You Are So Beautiful" by Joe Cocker.
Ooh, nice one.
Yeah.
I myself like Silver Springs.
Nice, by Stevie Nicks. Yeah,
yep,
nice.
Stevie
awesome.
Nicks.
Love
yep.
it.
What is your coffee order?
Like a plain coffee, black coffee. That's it. And I
started
like,
drinking black coffee today.
Nice. Welcome.
Yes.
Welcome to the world. I like fancy coffee a lot. So I do like to go to like a very fancy like third wave coffee shop with a hipster barista pouring my coffee through a beaker of some kind. I'm paying $6. Yeah.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
Who is your first celebrity crush?
Probably Jamie Gertz in The Lost Boys, which I recently rewatched. Do you remember her? Jamie Gertz?
Short hair?
No, long hair.
Long hair.
Yeah, long black hair.
Yes. I remember the short-haired girl more.
Yeah, she was the her probably most famous movie was The Lost Boys, and she had like smaller roles in other movies. But
I'm thinking of The Goonies.
Thinking of The Goonies. You're thinking of Martha Plimpton. Jamie Gertz. I also, for a lot of boys my age of a certain age, Carrie Fisher also in Return of the Jedi.
Oh yeah, great one.
Yeah,
good one. Who is the nicest musician you've ever met?
The nicest musician? Like, does that extend to, like, friends? Friends or, like, does it have to be, like, celebrities that you met or something?
Why don't you do one of each?
I mean, the nicest, like, general bunch of people in, like, my world but who are famous are, like, it's, like, Team Wilco. Like, all of those people, that's just, like, the nicest vibe. But like in like, I don't know, people I know like Anais Mitchell, Josh Kaufman.
Oh yeah.
And me. We're like the three nicest.
Yeah. The three amigos of friendship. Okay. First album you bought with your own money?
I think it was the Footloose soundtrack or the Ghostbusters soundtrack.
Both excellent choices.
One of those two.
Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Apples and oranges. I think they're too different, but I think probably for me, Beatles, like if I was forced, but I love the Stones too. So
final question, where's the most beautiful place you've ever visited?
probably Big Sur, you know, and it's like right up the road, but like, it's as exotic as anything. I was in New Zealand too, and I did get my mind blown by that. And possibly the Grand Tetons as well.
Nice. Great answers.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's it. We finished the lightning round. We've made it to the end of the interview. Thank you so much. You're a wonderful guest. It's been really nice to talk to you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by John Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. You can make a contribution and support Basic Folk at our website, basicfolk.com. Leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Tell a friend, tell your mom, tell your financial advisor, tell your veterinarian, tell your brother's best friend from high school. Seriously, it really helps. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.